When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Then you start engaging with people who really do see you as a person and who you are, because, you know, and then they will come to you, because that thing in your life, you, once you open a door or you come to bring yourself, you attract the people like that. And the ones who don't, well, then you keep walking, right?
Hello again. I'm Emmeline Mondo, and this is Mondo Moments. Life is made up of millions of tiny moments. I believe one of our tasks as humans is to be present for as many of them as possible. When you reflect on the unforgettable events or incredible memories in your life, zoom in, and there will be these little moments before or after the event that sit in your heart space. The moment that you knew things would never be the same again, the hour you felt the shift, the minute that saved your life, or the second that changed it. These are the moments that build movements. Sometimes they are global, and other times it's just the simple first step to change. Join me as I uncover these moments with my inspiring, innovative, and extraordinary guests. Othello de Souza Hartley is a mixed media artist based in London. His artistic mediums include photography, film, performance, sound, drawing, and painting. He received an MA in Fine Art from Camberwell College of the Arts and previously studied photography at Central St. Martin's. Othello's work explores identity, masculinity, gender, emotions, and the changing perception of the black body. I sat down to speak with Othello on a blustery Friday morning. He shared stories of home that made me understand him a little more, and his unique and curious way of being was ever present. The detail in his art is mirrored in his life. I hope you enjoy this as much as I did. Othello, I'm so honoured to be speaking with you today. I spent the morning looking at your pieces and your work, and I was reminded of your brilliance. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm good. A little tired today, but I'm good.
Yeah, you did tell me before we started recording you'd been painting, right?
Yeah, I was painting till 12 o'clock last night.
Yeah, I know those. We were talking about those when you get in the zone and you just feel like you need to keep going. You just kind of have to listen to it. So good on you. Right. I actually want to begin this conversation. I want to look in to a bit of your childhood, because I've met you as a man, and there are elements of you that I feel, elements that I find really, really intriguing. Mm-hmm. And part of that is your way of being, and a kind of like a freedom that I feel that is really important to you. But before we get to today and everything that you've created, can you tell me a little bit about growing up? Because I think, were you born in London? Were you born in the UK?
Yeah, I was born in London. I was born in Islington. And do you want to talk about my life? Oh, I've come.
I'd like to know that when you realised you'd be an artist and what inspired that, and also just, you know, growing up. So Islington, we're talking London, like maybe 80s, I think, I'm guessing. But like, I'm guessing that there weren't many people who had the life that you've shaped for yourself now. So I'm curious about what inspired you and what moved you as a boy.
Okay, so the thing is, I didn't ever decide to become an artist. It just happened.
Wow.
When I was a child, I was always doing like dressing up. Mm. I would dress up and do plays at home. And recently, it's funny because I met a friend of mine who knew me back, you know, when I was growing up, and said to me, "You was always sketching," but I don't remember this.
Really?
Yeah, but I remember always doing dressing up and doing plays at home. And then I remember that I was wanted to do ballet when I was a child. But I remember always a story about never being brave enough to ask my dad because we'd gone pick up my sister from ballet.
Yeah.
Sat at the back of the car and I've always wanted to do ballet. And I was like, And then when I became a teenager, I went off and started doing, went to performing arts school.
Yeah.
In Camden. I was going to performing arts school on the weekends.
Yeah.
And then it sort of continued from there. And I got into, did some drama, I went to like this drama school I used to go to on Tuesday evenings as well. And they just continued from there. I think WAC, it still existed.
I think I've heard of it. So can I ask, were your parents, also because you're called Othello, which I love about you, I wonder, were your parents like really into you being in the arts? And are you named after Shakespeare's Othello?
Yeah, I am. And so what happened was my dad wasn't, my parents, my mum was the more the person pushing us to be creative because she was really interested in the music.
Mm.
The story is that she had opportunity to sing when she was younger, but dad didn't let her go.
Mm.
And so she was interested in music more than any other arts. My dad is creative, but he was much more of a, he was more into, I would say more like sciences. But so that was his thing.
And yeah.
He was against art because he, well, not because he was against it, but obviously my dad was a generation where, you know, you got to get a job and art's not going to pay. So he was like, oh, you need to be like, they were always pushing me to be a doctor. Like, oh, you should be a doctor, you'd be a doctor. And then second from a doctor would be like a lawyer.
Yeah.
In the arts. But I just continued and I just continued and continued. And believe it or not, I never made a conscious decision. I just knew that was something that I wanted to do. And at some point I just said, I'm just going to pursue this life. But I remember being, when I was a kid, saying to myself that I don't want a normal life, which I didn't understand what a normal life was.
Yeah.
I remember, but I knew deep down inside, even though a child, you can't, when you have ideas and you have dreams, but they're not formalized because they don't come from nowhere, but they're just like visions that you get of your future. Everybody gets that, but I deep down, if I really be honest, knew that I didn't want a normal life, which I didn't know what a normal life was.
Yeah, yeah.
I wanted something different. And I think even at school, I felt like sometimes I didn't fit in. And certain boys that I was growing up with, and I noticed that. But you're not really aware of it, but there's something inside of you.
Yes, yes.
You don't really fit in. You're a bit different. And they noticed it. And there was always comments, but it just didn't manifest until I got to that age where I thought, you know what? I just need to find my path.
Mm.
And then when you find your path, you continue. But I actually, to be honest with you, I think the arts was calling me from since I was a child. And then as your confidence grow, I was going to do performance first, but then I realized I didn't really like being in front of the stage, but I knew I liked performance.
Yeah.
And I was always doing photography. And then that kind of took off first. But the other practices were there, and then I wanted to find a way, as you grow as an artist, to kind of bring things together and then stretch the other parts of your creativity.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what I love, I mean, that insight is so glorious, because as you were speaking, I was also now having visions of some of the exhibitions that you've gone on to do.
Mm.
But even from that young age as a boy, you were exploring dressing up. You were intrigued by the ballet that your sister was going to, and you knew within yourself that you wanted to do things a little different. Mm-hmm. And then in your project, so much of one of the things that I'm drawn to is that I see that your eye has a real appreciation for the human body. Mm-hmm. and form. And there's a kind of like the way that it's undressed, but also celebrated.
Mm.
It's like seen and raw. And it's like those things had kind of always been in you.
Yeah. So what I would say to you, a lot of that comes from, because I'm obsessed with contemporary dance and ballet.
Mm-hmm.
I go to a lot of performance and I just love how the body moves.
Yeah.
There's one key thing I will say in all of this is that having a dad, even though he wasn't, this is just going back a little bit because this will put things together. Having a mom that was always taking me to different things and showing me different things and keeping me open. And we always used to go for like drives and they're showing me different areas.
Yeah.
And my dad would like, we used to do this thing called Sunday drives. We just go around different areas. And yeah. And then having my mum and my dad, and having a father who kind of like, he was really quite ambitious as a person. Like he would, but having that kind of stability in my life and with the parents, even though outside might have been a bit different to that, that was kind of a good starting base for my life. And then having parents who had all different cross sections of people coming into the home. I've always said this, and this is really important, that we had like my Irish auntie, then another person, this Indian lady, then a Spanish. So when you grow up with a cross section of people, it makes you a different person.
Yeah, totally.
Not just people within our community, but outside of that community, outside of your culture. I think that really gives you a good
grounding.
Yeah. And then obviously you said I came from, I've always been observant and I've always been a daydreamer. I used to spend hours when I was a kid just daydreaming in my bedroom. I'd be at school and I'd be daydreaming. I'm just a dreamer. I dream and I visually dream things in my head.
Yeah.
And I even really dream stories in my head when I was a kid.
It's so, yeah, I love hearing this because I feel this in you as a man, because the grounding, again, as you say, with your mum and dad, like sometimes in East London, like there was a narrative kind of more through the 90s, I think, but like where artists had to be these like disheveled hot messes, like on drugs and like not knowing where they were going and stuff. Mm. All the stereotypes, obviously not all artists are like that. But when, like with you, what I saw in as an artist was that you can be curious, playful, different, and be grounded. And you always had that sense of, I mean, that's not to say that I'm not making the assumption that everything is always smooth sailing, but it sounds like having that sort of like stability at home, even just the presence of two parents meant that you had that sort of anchor, even though you aspired to do something different. You talk about art just sort of happening and not choosing it, but when did you decide to study it? Because you did the fine arts, right?
So the journey started in about the late 90s.
Yeah.
And then I studied, I was at St. Martin's. Then I took a break, quite a big break. And then I went on to do an MA in fine art. I thought that, you know what, I was doing everything else. I was doing my work and I started to get commissions. But one of the things that I felt that in myself that was lacking was contextualization.
Right.
I thought it was there, but it was just that I needed to be able to express it more.
Mm.
And I also needed to understand about working a bit slower in my practice, because I was more of a, then I went on to do this MA at Camberwell. So I had this amazing lecturer who really helped, and she was quite tough. She was the head of our department, Rebecca Fortrum. And Rebecca Fortrum would lecture, and she would do things like, I'd be having the crit and she'd just look at me and with no light thing, and she would literally watch the ground open up and swallow me when we talk about my work with nothing in her eyes, just a blank stare. And then at the end, they should come up to me and say, did you enjoy that? And I was like, that is so psychotic. It's like, but you know what? It gave me doing that MA changed everything. It gave me such a grounding about, yes, being creative, but also to really understand and formalize your work and having more context behind it.
Do you think that sort of intense, she gave the sort of the attention and intensity for you to truly look at yourself?
Yeah, and also what it does is, like, for me, it's like I always like to continue to learn. So that was like the next step that was missing from my practice. But before, it was, I was doing the okay practice, but it gave me like a self-confidence to go even deeper into my practice. And also to let go of certain things. Because my work's becoming a lot more silent and it's a lot more still, and not having to have so many layers, and sometimes just having simplicity in the work. So I think that was one of the switches.
Yeah.
And then continually keep practicing, and then getting this new studio. I finally found an environment and a studio that, I need a bigger studio now, actually too small for me now, but the real space to really focus on the work. And that was when I got that studio in 2018, I think it was, yeah.
Yeah. And is that where so I would like to lean into the masculinity and exploring that. Is that from where the masculinity work was born?
No, so the masculinity was born on my MA course.
Oh, right. Okay. So prior.
So prior to that, what that studio has just made me do is actually push my practice further. So I've got a space where I'm around other inspiring artists, and it's really pushed me to push my work further. And also, I've never taken on a studio before, but this is quite an expensive studio. It's a cost, so it's like, you've got to get serious. I'm really pushing and my practice, and now it's pushed it so far that now I need to get a bigger studio.
Yeah. So you're represented by a gallery, right?
No, I'm not. No, not now.
Oh, you used to be. And so what's the difference with when you're working by yourself in terms of like taking on a studio like that with pieces and commissions and that kind of thing? Do you now feel a sense of freedom because you're sort of like creating what comes up and then...
No. The gallery never put pressure on me, just that obviously we know there's an explosion of the African art market in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
The problem from I've had is that, not as a problem, but it's where do you place me within this market? And I just had me in my gallery. They were putting no pressure on me, but it was like the work that I'm producing doesn't fit the kind of the stereotype narrative of what African art should be.
Wow.
And that's what you get a lot in the art world. So you get some of the African artists, they want the people who control the art world, they want a specific, a sort of narrative. So I don't really fall into that. My work's not, it has some colour, but my palette is quite dark.
Yeah.
So there's a conflict there. And so that wasn't so there was never pressure with the gallery, but I just felt that my work is not in that market. My market needs to be a broad market.
Yeah.
And so I think that's where my thing, so there's no pressure. So all I'm doing for myself is that it's that point in life when you become so comfortable with every part of your life connects, like my home life, the way I dress, everything all connects.
Yeah.
And so the work that I'm producing is solely from within me. It's no pressure. And you get to the stage where it's like, well, then the people who like your work will come to you. So now if I get a gallery now, it will be the gallery that appreciates the work.
Yeah.
I mean, there isn't anyone who's selling... Sorry.
No, well, this is why I adore you, and I think that your story is so important, because that little piece there that I think a lot of Black artists will have this experience in which institutions or labels, or, you know, I've spoken to musicians who've had the same thing where they want to present you as a version of Blackness that they see or that will sell, mm-hmm. when the true act of freedom is to do what you want to do on the grounds of your expression, and not to fall into another bracket. And, you know, I think parts of, again, why I think your story is important is because it might take a bit longer to maybe be seen or be understood when you choose this path, but it's so important that we not only see examples of choosing your expression based on what's coming from within, but it's important for your growth, and you're choosing you over fitting into a box. Mm-hmm. And what they miss, what's so crazy, is that what the institutions miss is that is the radical act there. That's the most radical act, actually allowing an artist to just express without falling into a bracket that you want to sell.
And I wouldn't fit in the box. I've always had people challenge me, like, you know, from both sides, you know, people always question me like, or you know, we won't get into that, but, you know, people always questioned you, like, whether, you know, you're the person who you are in certain respects. And I've, to be honest with you, I've never really fitted in a box. The way I always look at it is that I know who I am. I don't need to go around talking about it, because I get up in the morning, look in the mirror, I know who I am. And so I don't really tag on to when people say, like, I know there's this whole question now about, they put you, like, are you a Black artist? I'm just like, I'm an artist. And I understand why some artists do those sort of things, and the reason behind it, because we know there isn't the reason behind it, but it's just like, I'm trying to just be true to myself, and most of the days I'm just a fellow being a fellow.
Yeah, you so are. I mean, and there's so much power in that. But, you know, in that, because I know that there might be Black listeners, or, you know, young aspiring Black artists who are like, yeah, but like, as a Black artist, this or that, the way that you seem to have explored this is let your work speak. So even though, you know, you're committed to being who you are, your exhibitions and sort of collections do mainly incorporate Black bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Like the piece that I was in, that was all Black women, right? And that was a sort of celebration.
Exactly.
Do you feel that that's sort of your angle? Like you just let your work speak?
Exactly. And I'm actually quite a quiet person. I'm very private outside of the, you know, everything else. I'm quite a private person.
Mm-hmm.
My work is my voice.
Yeah.
I don't need to my work. This is what I give. This is my language.
Can you talk a bit about what inspired you to do the project? The project that I was in was called I Am, right? Or
yeah, so I Am. So that came from many years of conversations with Black women, hearing things when I go and visit my grandmother, who was sort of mixed. She's mixed race kind of thing. And this whole thing about the colorization in the Black community. And I'm not really actually talking about the white community, I'm talking about the Black community, colorization in the Black community, and also the perceptions of Black women as not being attractive. My things come from everywhere, from things like popular culture, watching this documentary about how Black women on dating apps are the least likely to find dates on dating apps because they're the least desired women. And things like that, and Black women not considered beautiful. And then you got from like things in slavery, and then like the colorization in our own communities. It's all these things, and I've been hearing about Black men for years, and it's a conversation to Black females, my friends.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I need to do a project. I was doing a masculinity project. I thought I need to do a project that speaks to, one, how I see Black women,
but yeah.
I highlight the strength and the power that the Black women that I know.
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, a lot of who I am has been shaped by Black women. My Black female friends have really shaped me in a way that, to understand myself, to be honest, you had to look after myself.
Yeah.
And through my Black female friends.
Yeah.
Even understanding my own health. If I could do that, it's come through my Black female friends. It's true. They get me to look at certain things of myself, and understanding me is being shaped by a lot of Black women. And I just had so many powerful Black women. I thought, you know what? I need to do a project about Black women.
Yeah. And
also, you know, it's the naturalness and the beauty and celebration of Black women. And that's what our project was about.
It was stunning. And it was really beautiful to be a part of it. And I'm going to make sure I share some of the images of it on my Instagram, but I'll direct you to Othello's page as well in the show notes. But, you know, as a Black woman, like I've been photographed a lot and worked in different studios. And when this project came about, I immediately trusted Othello's request and vision because I just knew that it would be respectful and meaningful. And, you know, it was nude. And so I was like, but he was like, I'm going to ensure that you feel comfortable and, you know, fully respected and it will be a great shoot. And there were just little bits of detail on that set. You know, had a female assistant, like whenever I felt uncomfortable, I could say. And, you know, obviously this is my friend, so I knew I'd be comfortable, but just watching the attention and the real passion for what Othello was doing with that piece was really moving. And I think it really had an effect because it made quite a few headlines and had a lot of features. And I think, I mean, I speak for myself, but I think the women who have taken part in it as well felt empowered too.
Yeah, so. And the great thing is that I didn't even know. I only know out of all, I think a couple of you I knew, but some of the women are just women who came forward who have never been nude before.
Oh, really?
There's a couple of women there who came who've never been nude before, but heard about the project but wanted to get involved.
Nice. Okay. Well, slightly moving on, still in the realm of your creations. I was reading an interview earlier, in which you were talking about film, and you said, I enjoy the process of working with film. It's almost like a ritual, loading the film, which gives you time to think, and it's magical. Then going into the lab and that unsettling feeling, hoping everything has come out how I envisaged it. And I loved that you described it as feeling like a ritual and magical. I've just again caught a clip of one of your recent films. So how has film been moving you recently? And
that was talking about photography film, because that was talking about how you load old old fashioned and you load everything. So I'm really quite into this. How it all connects to my life is that I'm really into people like craft things. So loading the film is like, the old film is like, you load the film, you've got to take it out. It's a whole process.
Yeah, yeah.
Something that I'm really interested in, and I think during the lockdown, I became more interested in it. Like now, like I've got a tailor who makes stuff for me. Like I'm having a pair of sunglasses, mate. And I found my friend's dad, who's almost like retired, he's like almost retiring, and he makes the glasses by hand. It's this connection to this craftsmanship that I really like.
Mm.
And there's a passion behind it. So when I'm working with film, it's like you roll the film and there's a hands-on connection with it. And then you go to the lab not knowing how it's going to turn out. Just like this, I went to the other day and he's the elderly man now. I went to see him and he was like, I'm going to do the glasses like this. And then I might have to do this. Workshops like mine are not around much these days. And you're talking to him and this is like passion.
Yeah.
By hand, he goes, and if you don't like certain parts, I will sand down certain parts, and I can relate that photography because it's just like his craftsmanship, and when he's looking at you, he's like, he's glinting his eyes because he knows everything, how the glasses should fit. That's how I treat photography.
Yeah,
like that craftsmanship. And then when you're talking about the film, for me, what it is like certain projects relate to certain projects. Like I'm working on another one, which has been like, I've been trying to raise the funding for more than three years now.
Mm.
And unfortunately, my dad passed now. So, and he found out only about it in 2019.
Right.
And I've been working on it for 2 years. And he was going to be part of it. It's called Fathers and Sons Relationships.
Oh.
And it's a conceptual piece about, and we got actually 180 Strand who offered to give us the space for the exhibition.
Mm.
We've got to shoot the film and we've got to raise the money, which is like 47,000, which we're trying to raise, and raising it for the last like nearly three years. And we nearly came close twice.
Yeah.
Sponsors, and then Brexit happened, then we lost out, and then it's like, anyway, by working,
you'll get there.
Yeah, we'll get there. But what it is for me is that each project lends itself to a specific medium. So if I try to do a certain project with a specific medium, it doesn't really highlight it in its best. So maybe that certain project has to lend itself to film, some have to be painting, and some photography. It depends on the project, and that's how I treat it. So with film, for me, there are certain projects I cannot express it through photography. So that's when I have to switch to do it as a film.
So I guess both of them in their own right have elements of ritual to it, and they inform the process. I also really love what you're saying about being attracted to craftsmanship and that connection to it, as in you enjoy it in your practice, and then you're being it in your world, as in like it reaches out to everything that you do and are.
I love quality. You know, I mean, like I really like things that are like quality. Like even the art shops I go to. I used to go to like these really like big art shops, like Cat, you know, those big ones.
And
I
them.
And I went there one day and someone's like, oh, just use that. And I was like, well, I'm trying to have a conversation with you. And the woman just like, that one. And I was like,
Yeah.
But now I started going to like this, about 2 years ago, I started going to the one near where I live. It's like a family run business.
Yeah.
And I go there and like, even like a few weeks ago, he was like, we were thinking about you, fellow. And two canvases arrived and they've been torn, but in the size that you use. And the manufacturer said, just chuck them away and we'll replace the two that got damaged in transit. And he said, well, fellow, we thought of you, we kept it for you, and let us know what if you want to use them and see if you can do something with it, then do it. And I said, yeah, I'll take it. And it's really like, it's a family-run business. I think the son and the daughter runs it now, and the parents are sort of semi-retired. And you go in there, and it's like a conversation. We're talking about the materials, and there's another shop by British Museum, small shop. And you go there and you have a conversation. And I love that. Do you know what I mean?
It's like, yeah, I hear you.
But you can have talks about things like pigments and the right colour, and you can describe the work. Well, maybe you need this. And it's like, I love those conversations. Just like the guy who's doing the glass. You have a conversation and it's, and when people are passionate about what they do, I love that. So if you're selling me, I think, and it's exactly like my framers, who is my frame for my photography. I met them and the guy was just talking about the grains of woods and I was like, man, you've got me already.
Yeah.
You've got me.
Yeah, yeah. It's so true. Like life is so much fuller when you can pay attention to like the intimacy of it. And, you know, quality as well is just, experiencing attention, you know, people who are paying attention. And there's so much to, there's so many beautiful moments to be had. Like just the thought that like in that shop, they could say, oh, we thought of you before we threw those out. It just like, that's the kind of, I feel like there'll be a lot of that. A lot of people looking for that kind of connection post pandemic, because I think the slowing down makes you realize what it is that you want. Yeah.
And I think I've always been there, because like, even my printer, Roy, that's Printer called Bayer, right? And he prints, when he goes into the print, because a lot of my work, exhibition work, is hand printing. When I kind of, I do a lot of hand, I go for hand, even when I shoot digital, I transfer it to a negative to hand print it.
Oh, right.
When Roy goes into the back dark, because I can't afford to do it as a film project, I'll do it digital, then transfer it to negative afterwards.
Yeah, okay.
Hand printed. And Roy, when he goes in there, he will keep on doing prints until he gets it right. He's like,
really?
A bit of red in there. No, look, if you're not happy, give me a few minutes. And this guy will keep on going until he gets it spot on. And then you see that smirk on his face when he's got your print right. And you're like, you got it, Roy. And he's like, yeah. I knew you wanted that. I thought a bit more there, a bit more like this. Da, da, da. And he's virtually just working it out. But it's like that kind of attention and detail and that passion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think your dad had that as well? That sort of like...
My dad was dapper. My dad, if you see pictures of my dad, he was like, when he was working, always had tailor-made suits.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing, I love it.
He always had tailor-made suits. His car was always clean.
Yeah.
That was like very specific, you know, when he was, anyway, when he retired, he let go for a little while, but you know, but and he was sort of coming back to it. And then, but he was like, when he was working, had to have his suits tailor-made because he wanted his trousers to fit right. And he was like, very specific.
Love that. You know, this podcast is about the moments that change your life. And it just so happened that, you know, when I reached out to you in 2020, you did tell me that of your dad's passing during COVID. And you know, thank you for sharing it with me in that moment, because, you know, it's just always very challenging. But one of the things that I've heard from you is that moment has sort of been a shift in your life. And for the positive, in a way that, like, in the way that you now are being. And, you know, there's that old saying that death has a way of creating new life.
Yeah, exactly.
And I wondered if you could share a little bit about that, because I think it informs your project.
Yeah, I said when my dad died, it's like my dad was expecting that. We were actually making plans for the summer. He got COVID, and when COVID happened, he was more worried about me because I was in China the year in 2019.
Right.
When I came back, I had this really weird illness, and he was so worried. And then when I was going off, because I teach at the university sometimes, he was really worried about me. And then we had little jokes about what this COVID's about.
Yeah.
When he got it, he didn't know he got it, because I found out, we joked about it, and he goes, do you think you got COVID, Dad? And he was like, hey! And then... literally in a space of a week it got really bad, and then he had to go to hospital, and then he died that early morning. And I did find a text saying that he had died, but the interesting thing is that we were talking about things, because there was a restaurant in Brixton that we drove past, and you could sit outside, and we were talking about this in the winter again. He said to me, oh, when the summer comes, let's go to that restaurant, sit outside and have some food.
Yeah,
we look forward. So he wasn't expecting, I wouldn't expect it, and it was an unexpected death.
Yeah.
He did have diabetes, so I think when people have diabetes, that really, the COVID really affects you more. But it's that moment when you see someone pass, and my dad never lost that spirit for life.
Yeah.
He was a person who loved living, so when you see his life gone just like that, and you weren't expecting it.
Yeah.
He was making plans of other things. I think what it made me realise is that, you know what, life really can just go at any moment.
Yeah, so fragile.
And he always used to say to me, like, stay positive, stay away from negativity. He always tried to keep a positive life alone, because, you know what, negativity will overtake you. And he always was pushing, saying, work hard, be positive, and always produce quality. And that's, when he passed, it was like, you know what, life really does come to an end. It's something like hits you, it's like, it does really come to end. And especially someone who was full of life. And I was like, you know what? I've shifted away from people in my life who I just felt have a negative interaction. This has cleared the deck.
Yeah.
Not in a horrible way, but, you know, just in a nice way, like, I'm going to let you go with love. And I'm now going to live my life, because my dad would have hated if he ever knew that I'd be like sitting there miserable going, oh, that's the, he would be like, he could got cremated, but he'd be turning wherever he is now.
Yeah.
He'd be like, what are you doing? He'd be slapping me head going, wake up, enjoy your life. And that, I'm going to push my life as much, do everything I can, push it, don't have no boundaries. Like, just go do what the live the life that you want, because at the end of the day is, we're all going to end up one place. So you know what? And like, I wrote, literally, asked me to do this teacher training recently.
Mm.
I wrote this letter to the university. No, I don't. I said, actually, you know what? What I bring to the university is my practice. I don't want to do teacher training. And it's like, after this period, I want to live the life I want to live.
Yeah.
I offered something in America recently to teach, you know, more full-time. And I was like, nope, more money. But you know what? I just want to live my life, whatever it means. It's not about how much money I have. I just want to live my life and make sure that I'm doing the things so that, you know, when you get to a certain age, I want to smile rather than being, oh, I wish I lived my life over again. I don't want to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gosh, thank you for sharing that so beautifully. You know, every now and again, I meet people who there's like ways that they are that makes me curious about their parents, because I'm like, you're just so, there's something about you that like you must have had a bit of grounding or like teaching from. And as you've shared like all of these traits and teachings that your dad gave, like the beauty is that so much of him will live in you, in what you value. So yeah, it's really beautiful. So thank you for sharing that. I mean, another area in which I think you have definitely, you were living your life courageously and exploring, is that you're another one of my artist friends who has been to my hometown, Uganda, Kampala. And I just, and you loved, and you know, that was a residency, right?
Oh my God. You know, just sitting, I've been to Morocco before that, but just setting foot on the continent is just, and especially Uganda was amazing. Because we've had this rumor in my family that there's East African in my family. And a lot of people thought I was East African anyway. And so when I was there, people were like, are you Ugandan? My name, you're Okello. I, a woman wrote on a bit of paper when I was doing my receipt. I said, I'm a fellow. She goes, and she called her friend and goes, he's one of them. She goes, one of them. And I know what she meant. She's one of those that go abroad and they come back and thinking they're no longer.
Oh, no longer like Ugandan enough. So she thought you were just trying to be like, it's actually Othello, not. And because Okello's an Acholi, was she thinking it was Acholi?
Yeah, because she thought I was on the border. You know, the part when you're on the border between Kenya and Nigeria.
Yeah, yeah.
So she actually wrote Okello on my feet. Like, one of them. I was like, no, I'm not. Because she thought I was working on the board and come and think they're all stush now. And they're like, I'm trying to be your. And I'm like, no. And she literally, you know, Ugandans tell me women can be quite feisty.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah. She goes, in a subtle way, though.
She goes, he's one of them. And I was like, no, no. I'm literally not.
I'm telling you the truth. That's so funny. I think you did were you doing a bit with 93 Feet East?
I was there and I did a residency. And I didn't know what I was going to do when I went there. I just knew that I read about this red soil.
Yeah.
The first starting point. I had no clue. And I just went there and I adapted this thing like after 2 weeks of keeping quiet, listening and letting the stories and the atmosphere dictate the work. And then when I got there, what I realized was that so many people, because I think Uganda's got the second youngest population in Africa.
Yeah, yeah.
And everybody was just saying, I don't want to live in Europe. I want to live in Uganda, but we need infrastructure.
Yeah.
They were saying, I was like, the narrative that you get in the West is like, oh, every African wants to live in the UK. They were like, no.
No.
They were in Europe and they got, when they were said they were leaving, sister was like, but you got a visit to stay. And she was like, no, I'm going back to Uganda.
Yeah.
All I got was, I want to stay in Uganda. And they weren't just talking about Uganda. They're actually talking about Africa as a whole, as well as Uganda.
Mm.
Interesting. And all they kept saying is, all we want is infrastructure so we can do our work wherever we are, even what we can send. Like one guy in Uber was like, he does like computer stuff. He goes, I can get so much contracts from around the world if I had fast internet.
Yeah, yeah.
Talking about infrastructure.
Infrastructure.
So many people who just, and they were just so fed up with the Western narrative of Uganda and Africa they were just telling me all the time. And I thought, you know what? That's what my product's about. And that's why I had everybody. I wanted to use local tailors. I even got with the guy who was trying to do contemporary, the bark cloth, but making it into contemporary colors, which I used in the background.
Yeah, yeah.
Things. But it was all about the local people and working. It was like a collaboration with them.
Yeah.
Because they were just saying all the same thing. We love our country. We love Africa.
Yeah.
Well, we need to be able to network with the rest of the world. And all we need is give us the infrastructure and we can do it.
It's so incredible because that is what I loved. You know, my experience going back, I was born in Kenya when I was younger and then grew up here. But sorry, born in Kenya when I was younger. All right, I'll start again. I was born in Kenya and came to London when I was 3 and then spent all of my life here until
I think 18 when I went back for my first trip.
But obviously I'd picked up on the exact same narrative that, which was kind of like, you know, Africa's a terrible place, you won't have fun, like everyone wants to leave and come to Europe. But when I started going back, what I realized was like, first of all, a beautiful creative like community, which was like thriving with what they had. And also this very cool sense of people who, of young people who were like, nah, like they could be in Canada, they could be in America. They were like, no, like we want to be here. Mm-hmm. And I love the way that Ugandan artists support Ugandan artists. They're not looking to America. You know, like I think in West Africa, a lot of young people listen to American music. Mm-hmm. In Kampala, they're like, no, I'm listening to like the local, like Bobby Wine. Do you know what I mean?
Reggae, which is surprised me. There was like a lot of like, oh, like wow. It's like, yeah, Bobby Wine and reggae. That's, I was like, wow, okay.
Well, there's a big Rasta community in Kampala, which is great as well.
I had this guy who come. Someone goes, you got to meet him, and he walked to my studio, go with a Jamaican accent, going, yeah, man. I was like, what? Yeah. And I was like, what? Did you come from England? He's like, no, man, I come straight from Yard. I was like, whoa. So straight from, I don't know what the connection is between, I don't think you need a visa if you're Jamaican, and like straight from Jamaica, straight to Uganda. And I was like, whoa, it's like, Uganda. I actually keep thinking about, should I get part of me feels like, should I get a plot of land somewhere and build a studio? Because there's a place that a lot of creatives are moving to.
Yeah.
It's in Kampala.
I think we should, as in like, I think the global community, particularly people like yourself who have experienced it. I think that if we were, maybe this is one for like off the record, but my sister's like got her land and planning, you know, some time back there. But I think if as a collective of artists, we were like, it wouldn't cost that much for us to put together something and get like a bit of land and like even just have it as an option, whether it's like you create from there or, but I think it's a good move.
Yeah, because a friend of mine out there, Gloria, she said that there's an area that she's living in. She runs the African Fashion Week, Kampala Fashion Week. And apparently they're all trying to create as a movement around there and it's become like a creative hub around there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is that in Kampala or outside?
Just past Kampala, as you're going past the hotel that I was staying in, and they keep going down, and on the way to Gather Beach, but it's on the left-hand side. It's the area. I'll tell you the name. I've got the name of it.
Oh, please. What? So have they all set up, like, are they making a community then?
Well, it's a bit more expensive than normal part of Kampala, but they're all, like, creators are moving. They're, like, designers and da-da-da-da, and they're trying to make it into something. Oh, the other option is to go to Ginger, but this part where they said that it's Kalukalu, was it? I was like, what my name is it? Kalukalu? I'll say your name anyway.
Send me the name. Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, these are the moves. Like, I think that the other thing, you know, that some people might not know, the flip side of it is like the way you live and eat is, I don't know if you felt this, but you kind of, when you spend a bit of time there, you suddenly feel a bit lighter and it's like, oh, wasn't expecting that. And then after a few weeks, it's like, oh, what is that lightness? And I guess the lightness is kind of like when you're in a place where you're literally, you're not even second thinking about all the things that come up in the Western world that sometimes are there that you don't even realize that you're cautious of. Yeah. And it's just, it's a different kind of freedom. And I believe that I also like eat a lot, eating from the garden, and like, I just eat very well there because it's, you know, it's all so cheap. I mean, I try to eat well everywhere, but our garden has so many
oh, I love the food out there. It's like great food and the people. And you, like you said, you have to question yourself. And then people recognize you, because when I was in the other part of Kampala, not the, you know, the main part, I come out of my hotel and the guy was like, you must be a fashion designer or something. And I was like, how do you know? Like, it wasn't like the questions you get in England. It was like different. I was like, and I was like, how can you say that? And he was like, I can tell you the way you look dressed. He's like, you must be a fashion designer or an artist. Something
or
like
artist, yeah.
You just like, wow. It's like, this is interesting. He goes, and it was just like those conversations. And it was just like, so you kind of like, when you're there, it's like they already know what you are, because they say, oh, they can tell what you like.
Mm.
I had a great conversation. And it was just like, and then, and you know, the people and of all the other shortcomings and stuff, but I was treated like, people would just reach out to me a lot and no one asked anything. They reach, and I've got so many people that I still keep in contact, call me regularly.
Yeah.
I support this youth group out there because they're doing this youth charity and I support them.
Yeah.
But I just met the most beautiful people who just like so beautiful and
yeah,
so well, and went overboard.
Yeah.
So I was, you know, make sure I was okay and stuff.
Oh, yeah. They're so good at hospitality. Like, it's really, yeah, the way that like a Ugandan will show you, like, especially once they've decided that they like you and you're in the family, like a Ugandan will for years and years have your back. Like, it's
so many magic poles in my life. Woo, that's another thing. It's so funny. I never had that. Literally, I was like, wow. It's so funny.
Oh, so funny. I love it. I love that connect that we've got there. It really makes me smile.
Yeah. And I will add, it wasn't because I was a Westerner. It was just like, there's lots of women out there looking for husbands. I was just like, coming up all the time.
Oh my God, they're so ready to marry and couple. It's quite intense.
It was like, if you say you're single, it's like, you're single? Why? Why? Are you married? No. And you know, obviously, I'm... Now, you know, I wasn't single, but I wasn't married. And like, they only ask you the question, ask you, are you married? I was like, no. Oh, no wife? No. Okay.
Jump.
Why'd you say no wife? That's it.
Oh, so funny. There's one question that I think is timely and incorporates your work. The 2020 solo exhibition, Catalogue of Emotions. Mm. How did you create that during the pandemic? And
so that was the first time, a guy that I was trying to work with for ages, and I got the show, and I just automatically, you know, it's always about the thing is like, when you get a show, which I could, you know, possibly could done it with them, but I remember this guy I had, we always talked, and I thought, no, let's give him the opportunity.
Mm.
Just give him the opportunity to do his first show.
Yeah.
He did. And it was the first show that I brought the painting and the photographer together.
And how was that? How did it feel? Was it a mixture of new and old, or was it all created?
It was not a mixture of new and old. But I was working on the work all the time because I'm always making work. So it's like, I've got so much work. You can just go into my studio and literally like a jigsaw puzzle. Okay, let me just take work and create a show. I did it, and people were like, oh my God, because sometimes that photography is seen as the lower hierarchy in the art world.
Right.
In this show, everybody was saying it was like, there's no hierarchy. It was like, and there's a language going on between the photography and the paintings.
Mm.
Like, oh my God, I prefer your paintings. And some were like, I like photography. You know, there was like different people like different things. But as a whole, people were like, oh my God, this really highlights how photography and things shouldn't be separated. It's like, this is an exhibition about art. And it was beautiful to see all these mediums together. But also, some people didn't know I was painting. And I also did some word pieces as well, because I also do word pieces. And people didn't know that. So when they came, they're like, you do word pieces? You do painting? I didn't even know what this was. And I'm like, well, it's because I don't have a gallery that shows all my work. I don't have a gallery at the moment. Because you got gallery readings. And also, people sort of always think I just do photography, but it's just that the work hasn't been out there enough. People are like, but a lot of people were surprised. They were like, I thought you weren't doing much. And I was like, you've created all this? I said, well, that's why I'm quiet sometimes, because I'm busy doing work.
Exactly. Yeah, it's beautiful. You are, this is what I was wanted to come to. You are the first man that I have on Mondo Moments because I launched on International Women's Day. And for that month, I had, you know, a host of glorious women, Shingi Shonua, Janelle Lewis, like Joycelyn Longdon. So I've been mainly speaking to women. And then I did a little poll on my Instagram stories where I was like, I think I just need to open this up and not stick to one type of person. And then everyone, you know, it was unanimous and I was happy. Everyone was like, yeah, obviously. Because obviously all the stuff that I often do with like sisterhood and women, I tend to, just focus my work. But I thought it was so important to expand, mainly because I'm a spirit-led person and I see people as like souls and illuminous, and like, I don't worry, and gender is irrelevant in that way. For me, you know, if you're a luminous, you're a luminous. But
I'm in touch with my feminine side. Oh, there you go.
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
I said I'm in touch with my feminine side, and I'm quite aware of that. So.
Exactly. Well, I enjoy that, and I think what I've observed in men normally who seem to just have this grounding and I think sort of power. Actually, they are in touch with their feminine energy. And I wanted to ask you, rather than say what does masculinity mean to you, what does the phrase like a modern man mean to you in 2021? And how do you balance those energies? Because you do it like so brilliantly.
Okay. First of all, is acknowledging that you've got a feminine, it takes years that you like realize. And sometimes it's been, you know, some women don't like, you know, I've had racial women like, oh, you've got feminism. I'm like, I don't like it. And I'm like, well, you know, what can I do? Embrace it.
Embrace
that you've got a feminine side. I don't need to be macho because what does, you know, you realize that all that machoism and all that stuff, it kind of just holds back your life. Do you know what? You're not free. You're just like, are you being true to yourself? That's another thing.
Statistics show that it's damaging because we've seen the rates of suicide in men specifically.
And you know what? It's what I said earlier on. I don't really care how I'm judged anymore. I'm just me. You know, whether I've got a feminine side and I've got thing, I don't even question it anymore. It's just this aspects of me.
Aspects. Yeah, I love that phrase. Aspects of you.
Embrace that part of me. And if you like it, you like it. If you don't, fair enough. If you like women say, oh, I like the men to be macho, even that is in a way toxic.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I want a man to be, like, what does that mean? You know, because you're creating, you're also perpetrating this toxic thing with men. If you say, I want a real man or a man, like, what is a real man?
Yeah, yeah.
And then also this thing is like, people are like, oh, I don't want to be children because I'll be conceived as gay. Or da, da, da. It's like, what does it matter? I remember, I'm not lying to you, I remember somebody, I wear black nail polish on my thumb sometimes.
Love it.
Someone said to me, but and they were really, disturbed. They're like, but are you worried that someone might think you're gay? And I said, why would I be?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it doesn't matter. It's like, what does it matter? Is someone... It's that the people want to think that because of that. That's their problem. It's not my problem. Getting on with my life, you know.
The way that you're able to embrace this and be with it and be with yourself, I feel like you're like, I'm Othello being Othello, but I'm seeing, or I want to highlight that in a society where men have so many standards and conditions pushed on them, the way that you're being is actually like, I want to say revolutionary, or it's ahead of your time. I think Gen Z, what I love about the younger generation is that they seem to really like, they're done with labels and they're moving in such an inspiring way. But you're kind of ahead of your generation with this, and it's really cool.
It's like I've always been this way, but it's like, I don't know any. It's like I've grown more confident in being this way. That's what the difference is. Or maybe I wasn't confident, but I've grown more confidence in this way.
Yeah. It's amazing. Your voice, your story, your way of being, which is my favorite phrase ever, is so important. And I really hope a lot of young black men, I was going to say who are aspiring artists, but just young men hear this because, it's a very important voice and experience, I think. So thank you for being fully yourself. What are your thoughts on the way in which we're visible and invisible in the UK, as particularly as Black artists?
Okay, we are invisible because there's a narrative about us. Everybody has a narrative about us, and they want to put the narrative on us without speaking to us sometimes. So it's like, I will put my narrative on you. I will determine how you are. So some people come to me and interview me, and they will say, I don't know, as a Black artist, and I'm saying, okay, stop. Yeah. Can we just start getting to know who I am as a first?
Right, right.
There's not just one identity of Blackness. Millions of us. If you're a person who's white, there's like, they're just a person, they're an artist or this person. There's an individualism in this person. When it's Black, it's like you're covered. There's this Blackness. Right. So, yes, we all share different skin tones. But where you grew up, who your parents are, what country you come from, even where you come from in that country, even if you grew up in London, whether you grew up in South London or North London, your life, even if you grew up in the same borough and you grew up in one side of the borough to the other, determines who you are. No, this lack of respect for our individualism, that's what bothers me. So that's it. That's what I find. I say that we need to be able to stand our ground now and not put up with it. So if everyone comes to interview me and they're like, oh, they start off with the black, I'm like, okay, can we stop here?
Yeah, yeah.
Me, come with better questions, and then I might accept the interview.
Example
that will summarize this. A couple of years ago, more than a few years ago, I was going through Covent Garden, and a woman ran up to me who was doing this, you know, the fundraising thing. She goes, oh, I love African Americans. I love it. And she's like African American Indian. I love African Americans. I've got some African American friends. I looked at her and I waited to finish, and I said to her, before I leave you,
yeah,
got my hand. My name's Othello. And I walked off.
Yeah.
You know what she did?
God. Yeah.
Ran up to me and she started crying.
Oh, God.
I said, she goes, I am so sorry. And I said, because that statement, what I did to
her, yeah,
I didn't want to question about it. Like, you can do the whole.
You went, here is my name.
I didn't want to do that because I'm very much into this minimalist thing.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you the opportunity. I allow people to use their brain. I'm very much like that. Even my work, I allow you to come with your own name. I allow you to think about the work.
Yeah, yeah.
One statement to her was, before I let her finish, didn't interrupt her. She's going about her African-American friends and she got loads of money. I just put my hand out and I said, and she put her hand out and I said, before I leave you, my name's Othello. And I walked off. And
that's so powerful.
That woman, she ran after me and she started crying and going, I am so sorry. I'm so sorry. It just hit her.
Yeah.
Because she didn't.
Yeah. She wasn't even seeing you. She was seeing this whole generalization like thing and then placing you in it without even taking the time to say,
exactly,
what's your name?
So when I do these interviews now, I'm like, you're going to come with that. So we have to take, we want change people, but when we start demanding what we want of respect to what we want and to understand, then we'll create a change. But if I don't believe in this begging, like, oh, please, please see us, I'm just not going to engage with you if you come with me that.
Yeah.
When you change it. And it, I'm not going to be begging, like, oh, the white world needs to accept me. I don't want to be accepted. I don't need to be accepted.
You don't need to be.
I'm happy who I am. But what I am good, but if you engage with me, we're going to meet in equal, one, equals. I'm not your person. Oh, you gave me opportunity because I know I'm working hard. So this is not a, you give me a show or something, but I'm doing the work. So I have the skills and the talent that, you know.
Yeah.
Not like, oh, it's like, please, you gave me the best. No, that's one.
Yeah.
Meet on equal terms. But if you're going to meet me, you're going to meet me as Othello. And I'm
doing that.
But if you can't meet me as Othello and start coming to me with your perceptions of what Black people are,
yeah,
you put that on me, you can keep it because I'm not going to engage with you. And I would say to you, come back to me when you are ready to engage with Othello. And I don't mind talking about the fact you said things that we're going through as a community.
Yeah.
When you start the conversation where you're open to listen rather than coming with your narrative. And then you start with the whole conversation about, oh, Black, Black, that. But you don't even know if I even need, what if I was one of these Black people who don't even engage in all that?
Yeah, well, who don't connect to it. Yeah.
If I was adopted by a white family and never had an experience of it, you know, I'm not sure that would be any difference, because you still have certain experiences of, like, we know there's racism, we know that kind of stuff. But at least get to know the person, and then we can move the conversation on. And those things. But don't come with my whole story written before you even spoke to me.
Yeah, so true. Oh, thank you for that. There's really nothing to add there, because you put it so perfectly. I love that you have created nonetheless, and the invisibility is actually, the invisibility to them hasn't affected you, because you're visible to the people that, you know, that are important, you know, and the people who can see it, and that's who it's for. So it's a very powerful stance to take.
We're there, because you don't choose to see us, but we need to have the confidence to say, I'm right here.
It's about loving our, it's about loving ourselves first, isn't it? Rather than seeking to be, like, accepted from the outside. It's like, if you fully believe it, then you don't actually need their approval. They're there or not, it, you know. Oh, I love it.
Then you start engaging people who really do see you as a person and who you are. Because, you know, and then they will come to you. Because that thing in your life, you, once you open a door or you're comfortable in yourself, you attract the people like that. And the ones who don't, well, then you keep walking, right?
Absolutely. Oh, thank you so much, Othello. That was, like, dreamy. Thank you for joining me. And thank you all for listening. If you are enjoying Mondo Moments, please remember to like, subscribe and share. You can also leave a review. That would be quite nice, because then I could read what you love and what you don't, and then just do more of what you love and less of what you don't. And I wanted to let you know, I also have a Mondo Moments room on Clubhouse. So if you're using that app, you can hear some more conversations in that room in the coming weeks.
Everyone is talking about magnesium. It's all you hear about. But why? What do we know about magnesium? Well, magnesium is the number one mineral that 75% of Americans are deficient in. If you are a woman over 35, magnesium will help you rediscover balance, energy, and vitality. Magnesium supports more than 300 enzymatic reactions in your body, including those involved in hormonal balance. From functional medicine doctors to mental well-being and female hormone experts, we all know that magnesium is the one mineral to improve all aspects of well-being and health. But which one? Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers. The trusted choice recommended by leading experts, with 7 best-absorbed forms of magnesium to ensure your body receives the support it needs for overall well-being. Go to bioptimizers.com/balance today and use code BALANCE10 for 10% off. Support your journey to wellness at bioptimizers.com/balance. Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, your foundation to optimal health and vitality.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply.